We at Screenfish believe that we are all created in God's image and want to show our support where we can to those in the black community who continue to battle against systemic racism. While our team strives for diversity, we can always do better ourselves in giving voice to those who need the chance to speak out and be heard. In our new series, Films in Full Color, we'll be examining films that explore issues specifically within the black community. For each episode, my co-host will be Jordan Toms, pastor of Warden Underground Church in Toronto, and our hope is that, through the lens of film, we might be able to shine light on the issues faced every day by African Americans. This week, Jordan and I welcome ThatShelf.com's Victor Stiff to look at broken fatherhood, racial injustice in the court system, and healing through forgiveness in Trey Edward Schultz's Waves. So welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Screenfish Radio. I'm so glad you could join us this week as we continue on our series called Films in Full Color, as we look at some of the issues that African Americans deal with every day through the lens of film. As always, I am thrilled to have my co-host Jordan Toms back. Welcome back, Jordan.
Hey, Steve. How you doing, man? It's good to be back. What is this, like week three?
Week three.
So, you know, it's been good so far. I'm excited to get into this one.
Yeah. It has been good. And welcome to the world of podcasting, Jordan, where you, where every week you're working on the next one.
Yeah, right. It's good, though, you know, something to add to the resume.
It's true.
Been good to be able to have these conversations and these dialogues with you and the guests that come on. So,
yeah. Yeah, it is for sure. All right, and this week we are thrilled to have with us Victor Stiff of ThatShelf.com. Welcome back, Vic.
Thanks, guys. It's fun to be back.
This week we're talking about Waves, directed by Trey Edward Schultz, and tells the epic emotional journey of a suburban African-American family as they navigate love, forgiveness, and coming together in the wake of a tragic loss. The film stars Kelvin Harrison Jr., Alexa Demi, and Sterling K. Brown. And as always, this podcast is rated S for spoilers. But gentlemen, I need to know, what did you think of Waves?
I would describe it as devastating in the best possible way. When I wrote about it, I think I called it an emotional tsunami, and the waves just keep slamming into you from the very first minute till the film's over. It just kind of leaves you level, emotionally raw.
Yeah. I'd already seen it, and I watched it again last night and tonight, and I forgot.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot. Jordan, what do you think?
Yeah, the film was interesting. I never seen it, so this was my first time watching it. And, yeah, man, it's just like, it's interesting that it focuses on a black family. But you see how quickly it reaches out to further than just the black community. It kind of highlights, like, tragic and trauma and just life. The ups and downs and the roller coasters, the hard things about it hits all of humanity, no matter what kind of color, no matter what race or belief or ethnicity you are. And so I remember when I was watching it, I thought the movie was ending soon because how it goes. And I was like, wow, like the buildup is pretty fast. Like, what's going to happen after this? And then I realized, oh, there's another storyline that follows. And to kind of see how that goes as well, which we'll get into obviously later. But yeah, it's just very interesting to focus on a black family, and you kind of see that very different from our discussions between Just Mercy and Queen Slim. But it doesn't just center around the black community. It extends out to all of humanity, I think. And it just kind of shows, like, life is real. Life is hard. And these are some of the things that can happen. So, like Victor said, yeah, it's just, yeah, a lot of waves. It's constantly going up and down, different emotions that hit you, different scenarios happen, and, you know, different things in life that is hard end up manifesting, and you kind of see it play out. So it was a hard and heavy film to watch and digest, and, you know, I was kind of always, you know, trying to hold back tears or fight it or just let a couple fall down, because I've seen people go through kind of similar things, And then if I can't relate to it directly, I just know that those things happen, and to kind of just have a more intimate understanding of it, even if you haven't gone through it, but how the film shows it is, you know, it's sobering, it's sombering. So a lot to discuss and kind of digest here, and I'm excited to hear your guys' perspectives on it as well. So, but it's a good film despite kind of everything that happens in it.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that I was calling it the best film no one saw last year that I saw. Sterling K. Brown is killer in that movie, man. He is killer. I mean, the kids are great, but his character from start to finish, I mean, he's all in. He's a great actor anyway. I'm not taking anything away from him, but in this film, I like every time he's on screen, I feel like I know what he's feeling without actually him saying a word sometimes.
Yeah, he wears his masculinity like a suit of armor, right? He's like, to him, the scariest thing in life is intimacy. So he can only connect to his son through, you know, when they're working out, when they're in the gym, if he's scolding him, instructing him. But he's not the sort of person who can say, I love you, right? And you can see as the family unravels, had he had that strength within him to just come out and be intimate with his son, like maybe this film would have had a much better ending.
I felt kind of too that his role was a, you know, not identical, but there's some similarities between you know, his show that he does with This Is Us, right? I think it's called This Is Us, right?
Yep. That
show.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of shows different things that happen to people, like relationship dynamics and things that can happen. And so this was just kind of a movie that I felt like, you know, was in his lane, but he did a great job. You know, obviously it's a different plot and different things they're highlighting that's happening, but I didn't see that this was something new to him.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's intense, man.
Yeah, he is.
I was wondering what you guys thought of his character. Honestly, this was not planned, but as I watched it again, I'm like, it's Father's Day this weekend. I mean, here you've got the story. And I will say this, one thing I like about this movie is it's not about the son. It's not about the daughter. It's not about the father. It's not about the mother. It's about all of them. They all have their own sort of stories, even if the perspectives shift.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, like, what did you think of his character and that journey that he was on?
Well, he's walking a fine line. I think a weaker filmmaker would kind of position him as a villain. And, you know, he can be unlikable and tough, but you can always feel that it's coming from a well-meaning place. Like, he's hard on his son because in his heart he believes he's helping him and that's the only way to help him. So I think, you know, another actor would just come off as an asshole and, you know, he'd be irredeemable. But you actually feel for this guy. You can see that he's afraid of, like, being intimate, that maybe he didn't have a father who raised him with the kind of love his own son needs. And, like, by the end of the film, you actually see him start in one place and end up somewhere completely different, and you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it was a lesser actor, if it was an underwritten character, then,
yeah,
you know, wherever he gets in the end of the movie, you wouldn't buy it. You'd be like, oh, you know, that's bull. I don't buy into it. But when he gives that speech to his daughter and they're sitting there fishing, it's like, you know, that's a powerful scene. That's one of the most powerful scenes of the year. And that's just, it's a testament to how well he develops that role.
Yeah, agree. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this movie is a lot about relationships and just different dynamics of relationships, and we can kind of go through it. But even within the family, you know, and Victor just talked about this, but when it comes to the dad, it's like he has a unique relationship with his son. He's closest to the son. He's not really there for the daughter, and the mom mentions that later on, you know. He doesn't know how to connect or be vulnerable until that scene that Victor just described, the fishing scene there. And his way of being a father and being a good parent is, you know, being hard, that kind of tough love. You know, he's able to relate and have conversations through, you know, training him, working out together, giving him advice, showing up to his game, even bringing him to his workplace and seeing what he does and those kind of things. But he's, like, very strict. So, you know, you got to be up at 5 a.m. so we can do this. Why are you sleeping at church, you know? But you could tell that he really loves his son, but he's just kind of missing that vulnerable side and that emotional kind of connection. as well, where the mom is a lot more gentle, you know? You see her as more gentle. I kind of see in her role in the movie, too, like, she had, like, the least kind of camera time and the least, you know, kind of role I seen in the movie out of the family. But I think that kind of described a bit about her, because she was working a lot until the tragedy happened, right? And the dad kept saying, you know, she's pushing herself too hard and she's working a lot. And she described how she was always there for the daughter, and the dad wasn't later on. But she's kind of like in the background a bit. And the other ones are kind of highlighted a bit more. So it's just kind of interesting there, yeah.
Well, she's actually the breadwinner, right? You get the sense that they have that wonderful life, the big house and the car, because of her. And he's kind of like tagging on to her businesses. So again, that kind of speaks to why, like, he can't be the macho man. This is my family. I pay all the bills. And he has to kind of overcompensate by, I'm going to be this tough ass who raises my son right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she was kind of an absentee mother, created a void for him to step in and kind of be a toxic male.
Yeah,
it was interesting. I hadn't realized that. You're absolutely right, guys. I never thought of the fact that he's probably not working. Well, no, he has a job, but he's not the one that's
for the mother.
He works for the mom.
Is he working for her? Because I thought he was resisting working for her.
No, it's her business.
It's her business, and he's the contractor.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And he says she would run the business into the ground if it wasn't for him. So he's at the head of it, because she's also, was she a doctor or a lawyer? So it's like she has two businesses.
Yeah, I think she was a lawyer because she talked about a family getting divorced, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? One of the lines that really struck me, he's talking. See, there were times when I really wanted to hate him. The dad, yeah. I mean, I really wanted to, but I like that you said I couldn't, because for every time he would go too far, they'd pull him back and you'd sort of see, that's what I mean, you could feel his heart. So like there's scenes where he's working out and he's pushing and pushing, and then there's scenes where he's working out and they're almost playing.
Yeah.
But like there's a line where he says, the world doesn't care about you or me. You got to work 10 times as hard to keep from being average. And I mean, that really struck me about his character. And maybe you guys can speak to this. I don't know, but I wasn't sure if he was referring to race or just in general because of like individuality. I wasn't quite sure, and it could be rooted in his own lack of self-image.
That's definitely a race thing. I've seen it referred to in a few articles. And that's one of the more interesting things about this movie, is that it's a story about a black family, but it's told from a white filmmaker, Trey Edward Schultz. Yeah. He wrote the movie and he directed it. So there was a lot of opposition to this, because it's like, why is this white guy telling a black story? So people are on both sides of the fence, whether he has the right to do so. So what's interesting is this story is partially based on his own life, and it was meant to center on a white family. But the lead actor he worked with in his last film, It Comes at Night, and he's like, I love this guy. He's my soul brother. He's my muse. He's going to be my Robert De Niro, and I'm going to be Scorsese. We're going to work together forever. And just by virtue of putting him in this role, that meant they had to make the family black. So, like, aside from that line, nothing about the characters in this film, like, they don't have to be a black family. It could be any family.
Yeah. Agree. And, I definitely would agree with what Victor is saying about, that's definitely referring to race. Like, the line he actually says, so he says, you know, the world doesn't care about you and me. And he says, we're not afforded the luxury of being average.
Yeah.
Right? That's definitely race. And it's interesting because as you follow kind of the story or the timeline of Tyler, the brother, the first part of the movie, like what Victor was saying, it could have been any family. It didn't have to be a bad family. You don't really see race problems except for two scenes where I kind of seen, okay, I called it like black reality check or storyline in the movie. And that's, it's like right after he said those lines, you see where he's driving, Tyler's driving through like kind of a, probably in a poor community by the liquor store, and you see cops harassing a black guy at the liquor store, right? Mm. And it's kind of like, oh, you know, that's normal. But he gets to escape it because where he lives. And then when he goes to the clinic, and then the woman protester calls him a nigger.
Right.
So it's like, okay, yeah, you know, there's still racial tensions and there's still those things. But outside of that, wasn't really like how Just Mercy and Queen of Slim focused like a lot on that. Outside of those things, I didn't really see anything in terms of those things.
Does that change the movie for you guys? Like, do you feel like there should have been a stronger black voice? Is there something you would have changed in that, from that regard? Or maybe that's an unfair question.
Well, I think it's problematic in movies that black people are cast to play black characters insofar as they have to act what's conventionally seen as black, right?
Right.
Like, you put someone in there to be the cool person, the sassy person, or a thug, you want to hire a black person to do that. Ideally, you should be able to put, like, every race on a dice, you know, like Asian, South Asian, white, African, roll the dice, and then anybody, like, it doesn't have to be a white person being a doctor. It can be an Asian person. It can be an indigenous person, right? So, in like, you should be able to just cast anybody that way. But where the waters get murky is, like, you should let white creators tell black stories as long as they do their homework and they're empathetic and they have black voices informing their decision of how to write these characters. Mm-hmm. The problem is Trey Edward Schultz gets to tell a movie about black people and there's five up-and-coming black filmmakers who they don't get a chance because he's taking up all the air in the room. Mm-hmm. It's like the studio says, we already have our black movie. We have our Queen and Slim. We have our Waves. Now this, like, the next Barry Jenkins doesn't get to make a movie because Trey Edward Schultz got to make one, right? Mm-hmm. And I love the movie, but, like, you know, you can make the case, like, maybe he should step aside. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah,
I never thought of it from that perspective. Like, I don't know all the film directors and the studio stuff. Like, you have that knowledge and awareness. But that's interesting to hear that. I think, you know, regarding should there be more of a black voice? It's a tricky question because I think, you know, kind of the plot of the movie and what it's trying to convey, you know, like we talked about, it transcends just the black community.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I know some black people that are in, like, upper middle class to rich communities that I can identify with this community or with this family, right? Down to just, you know, education and the luxuries that they have and those kind of things. And so I don't think this movie was just addressing, you know, this is a black family that is rich. And these are the things that they're facing as a black family. It's more so, you know, this happens to focus on a black family.
Yeah.
And situations come up and this is kind of the choices and the responses to those things. But it could be anyone. You know, I don't know how you guys feel too about, and maybe this is for later, but when Tyler is before the judge and he gets sentenced, you guys think that sentence was too harsh? They called it a mercy sentence, but do you think it was too harsh? You think it would have been different if it was a white person, or you think it would have been the same, or if it doesn't have to be white, but any other race. Because I was thinking about that too. Like, if this was someone else before him that just committed this, that committed this murder, would the sentence be the same or would it be different? But I don't know if that's something for later you want to talk about as we kind of go through the story.
No, that's fine. We can go there. I wondered that myself this time. This is the second time I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly with where we are, and like the last time I saw it was 6 months ago. This is the first time I noticed that he got, like, 30 years.
Mm.
Now, he killed his pregnant girlfriend. You know, it was a homicide, but it wasn't first-degree murder. He didn't shoot her in the head or anything like that. So, to me, it seemed harsh, but I don't know. Now I'm trying to be more sensitive to these sorts of questions.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Victor?
The justice system is rigged. It is not in black people's favor. You know, there's so many cases of, you know, black youth committing crimes and being charged as adults. There's all kinds of stats you can look up as if a white person and a black person are both arrested for carrying weed or cocaine, like the fine is it's like three times harsher for a black person. They get sentenced harsher. There's all these crazy stats that even when black people go to the doctors prescribe them less pain medication. Black women a higher rate giving birth in hospitals in America than white women do, right? So there's no way that a white kid from the suburbs would be judged as harshly as him.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too. There's so many of those things. So I see, and this is not just a movie and a hypothetical, but in reality, like this actually took place where I seen, you know, a white guy and a black guy be charged for the same crime, only have one prior, and go to the same court under the same judge, and the sentences was way different. White guy 2 years, black guy 22 years.
Yep.
Right? And it's like, why is that? Why is this happening? The same thing. Exact same thing, identical. Just happened at different times, same prior, same judge, same court, but two outcomes. And I just thought, wow, man, if we don't see that something is wrong and unjust here and that the system is flawed, then you're just ignorant towards it. You don't care. You're blind or you just, because it doesn't affect you and your community or people directly, you just don't care.
When crack was running rampant through the inner city in the 80s, it's the war on drugs. When the opioids are becoming a problem in rural America, it's an epidemic. Uh-huh. You know, got to be empathetic towards them.
Yeah.
It's a huge double standard.
Yeah. And this has been going on forever, man.
Yep.
Man, see, this is why I love these conversations, because I never thought of that. And just out of ignorance. You're right. You don't... You don't talk about that in the same sort of way. There's just different language that's used. It's like, oh, let's help here and let's hunt here.
Right.
It's something that I'm only becoming aware of now.
Yeah.
Not to juke too far out of the way on this one, but I was interested to see what you think about the different perspectives in the film, because there's a number of them. The film, first of all, the whole film structure is two different perspectives. It's the story of the brother, then it's the story of his sister.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how you thought that played out and how that affects the story.
I mean, that's the whole point of the film. That's the reason why it's called Waves, right? Mm. It's ups and downs. It's good and bad. It's literally making a statement that like your best day and your worst day are only a heartbeat away. So this was the fourth time I've seen the film, and I've picked up new things every time. But I believe like the first line of dialogue is when like Tyler, he's working out and he's like, you know, he's training for wrestling. His coach says, there are no second acts, right? Mm. That's like the first line of the film. That tells you everything you need to know. Because for Tyler, it's like he made a mistake. 30 years of his life is gone. There's no making up for it. And then the other thing is when the family's all together going for breakfast after church, there's a song playing in the song of the movie, and it plays towards the end of the movie. And it's what a difference a day can make.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's just showing you, like, for Tyler, it's the worst possible reality came to pass. And then for his sister, like, she could have went down a dark path after everything she'd been through. But, you know, she had a bit more love in her life. She had a bit more people showing her kindness. And then she, like, lived a much better life, right? So just, like, a difference of a day for two different people. You know, you can end up in jail and just seen as an animal. Or you could, you know, have people in your life who love you and support you, and you can... you know, be well adjusted.
Does she have that? It's interesting. You said that she has a little more love in her life. Does she?
Well, she gets the boyfriend.
He has the girlfriend.
Right. But that relationship is toxic, right?
Mm.
It's never good. It's a very self-centered relationship. It's all about like hotness and popularity and sending each other texts. When they get into arguments, you see how bad the arguments get so quickly. Right. And even if it wasn't something as dramatic as him attacking her in that garage in the first half of the movie, like it was going to end up bad some way or another. Right. Whereas with his sister, I believe her name was Emily. It's like she closed herself off from the world. She was just eating alone, no friends, off social media. And this person came and like she was so closed off to love and attention that she thought it was a joke. It's like, are you here to make fun of me? Are you using me? And then once she like opened herself up to love, and the same thing with the father, where he realized we wouldn't be in this predicament if I was a more loving and affectionate person. And he opens himself up to the daughter. Right. And he's like, all you need is love. Like, you know, the way we were before is wrong. We need to fix this. And that changes everything, because if she doesn't open herself up, if she doesn't have that boyfriend to kind of like, you know, lead her into, I don't know, more promising future, you know, maybe she gets into drinking, she hangs out with the wrong crowd, she starts doing drugs, she feels life is meaningless, right?
Love is an interesting word in this movie. I think one of the things they hear, I think it's in church, love is a four-letter word, but so is hate. And I think that that's a really interesting constant throughout the film, is this conversation of what does that really look like? And her relationship with Luke. By Lucas Hedges.
Yeah, what a stretch. Lucas Hedges plays Luke.
Yeah, he really had to act. Yeah, I don't know. It's their relation. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's interesting that you say it was all about texts. And I guess there's...
Yeah.
Tyler, is it Tyler? Am I saying it right? Yeah. Tyler's relationship. You know, they're Instagramming. They're sending pics, you know, everything without them seems to be more image, but they don't have that relationship in the second half of the film. His sister doesn't have that type of relationship. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought those perspectives was interesting too. So, you know, the film starts off like Tyler, everything is all bright. Everything is good. He's a popular kid. He's an athlete. He wrestles. He has a nice house, lives in a nice community, has his own car. He's afforded, you know, the luxuries that his family and his, you know, his father and his mother was able to give them through their hard work and all that stuff. Everything's going well. He has the girlfriend. But then it's kind of like it focuses on his arm injury. And, you know, he ends up having a level 5 tear, very severe. And things start to get bad from there. So everything was good. And then once it focuses kind of on that, everything kind of gets bad after. So he ends up injuring his arm and his shoulder. Then after that, he finds out his girlfriend is pregnant. He doesn't want to have the baby. They think they're going to go through with abortion. She ends up changing her mind. She can't do it. She wants to keep it. And he doesn't like that decision. You know, we're seniors in high school. Like, we got college, university after this. It's not the time. You know, she even says, well, how, that's your perspective, but you're not listening to me. Like, what about my perspective of what I think? And he has a lot of anger issues, you know, as well. You kind of see it in the film. And it's interesting that Victor did bring up that, you know, a lot of their conversation was, you know, through texting and that kind of stuff. It's not really intimate, like how you see with Emily and Luke. And this is one of the things where I looked at it with Tyler's story, the first half of the movie. I was just like, no matter where you are on the financial scale, bad things can happen to anyone and everyone. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Like, going back to the other films we talked about with Just Mercy and Queen of Slim and there's others, you know, these guys grow up in poverty. There's a lot of issues that they're facing, you know, and decisions that they make that's not the best. Here you have a black family that worked hard so that their kids can grow up better and have opportunities that they never had, but they still can't escape things like injury, right? They still can't escape things like getting pregnant and that decision. And all of these things. So, like, life hits you. You know, Luke's dad is dying, right? You can't escape death, whether you're poor or you're rich. So, it does a good job of kind of contrasting and giving parallels to things like that. And so, what I was thinking about was like, when you're in school, you have all of these things, and it's like, okay, you know, let's take these courses to help you so that when you graduate and you want a career and you go into the workforce, you're equipped to be able to do these things. Then I was thinking, like, well, what if you don't make it there? Mm. Like, Tyler's story, he doesn't make it there. There's other things I think should be mandatory in school for us to learn, like financial literacy, how to budget, how to do your taxes, how not to go in debt so you're aware of what you're doing and these kinds of things. People with anger issues, like, I don't know what the course would be called, but there's a lot of things that we've all been teenagers. Like, I've done a lot of dumb stuff when I was a teenager. I'm sure you guys have as well. If I had a mandatory class in high school where I was going through all of these things, that kind of just brought to light and talked about these things, like, hey, you guys may be going through this, and if not, you know, there's a high chance that you will be going through these things. Let's really address it and talk about it so that as you're going through it or when you do, you're kind of aware and can respond differently, potentially. Kind of like how they did, and I'm not saying that they need to do this, but kind of just like how they had that TV show on A&E you know, scared straight for those that were doing criminal things and just, you know, was rebelling or whatever. They brought them into a jail and prison to see how that life is, and they seen it. Some people ended up still going down that path. Some people it worked, and they're like, nah, I don't want this for my life, because they were able to kind of experience it, right? And so I was just thinking about these things, like, man, there needs to be something in school other than just English, math, science, which is important, but there's other things that are very important that is not taught that I think needs to be mandatory, because you might not make it there like Tyler did, you know? And then to kind of go on to the Emily side of stuff and the contrast of relationship, she's shut off, you know, Tyler's decision affected her. She was kind of in that group, but was still very kind of on the outside of it. You're right, she's at prom, she's with them, but she kind of keeps to herself. And then Tyler makes his decision and it affects her, so she shuts off to the world and to internet and social media and all this stuff. And she's lonely. And then even when Luke comes into her life, you know, she has low confidence or no confidence at all. Luke comes into her life and she ends up open up more. But it's funny, like a lot of the scenes that they're in together, it's just them two together still. Mm. She's still kind of shut off from everyone else. And even when they are with like Luke's peers and other people, like they're still, it's just them two with a group of people. So they're at the party and they're all doing drugs in the house. They're like in the kitchen just together, them two. They're not actually with them. Mm. You know? So that was kind of interesting too still. But their relationship wasn't over phone and text. They were, everything was intimate together. They met up. They did things as a couple. They talked. It was always around each other. And so it was a lot different from Tyler's relationship. So that's something I picked up as well, like in terms of kind of the contrast between the two relationships of the brother and sister.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't put, until this conversation, I hadn't put so much stock into the interaction via cell. And she actually deletes all her social stuff because of the cyberbullying that she's getting, which when I first watched it, that's what I sort of clung to, is like, oh, you know, people online are jerks and stuff like that. But, you know, when they put their phones away, like they're just together and they're free to be awkward and safe, which now, as you guys are talking, I realize I see was not there in Trey's relationship. There isn't that level of safety.
Well, one relationship is performative. It's all about, look at me, look at us. You're living your own reality show. And the other one is based on, we don't care what people think. We're doing, you know, what feels right.
Yeah.
You know, very early on, that was established between Emily and Ty, or Emily and Lucas, when they're at the restaurant. And they say, F people, remember that? F people, F people. And that's how they live. Like, it was F everyone, it's just about us.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And we're going to do what we want. And as our feelings deepen for each other, and as we, you know, begin to love each other more, we're just going to do that, and who cares what other things?
Yeah. And not F people in a way that's bad. That was actually a healthy way to say that, if you can. Yes. It was like, really, as you said, it's like, we're going to do what we want. But it's not like that, as in, like, you know, whatever.
Yeah. It's not that we hate people so much as we're not going to worry about other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Forget the opinions of others.
Yeah.
You know, this may be a weird thing. It's just, we're talking about the relationship, maybe a weird thing to discuss, but I know, Jordan, when we talked about Queen and Slim, we talked about the sex scene in there and the intimacy there.
Yeah.
This scene is probably the most realistic sex scene I've ever seen on screen, especially for like two kids on their first time. It's just sort of like, sorry. But it's like not... It's like, again, it's part of that safety and that thing. Like, she's, oh, no, that's okay. Well, you want to try that again? Sure. You know, it's like.
Yeah. It's true.
It's awkward, but it's safe and it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was impressive. Because, again, you know, when you see these things, usually the music's playing and it's this beautiful moment, and they just wanted these two kids to be real in this space. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of their relationship. And you know what I love? I love that her text, when she's texting her family again, she says, "I love you," but she deletes it. Not because she doesn't want to say it, but she says, "I really want us to be a family again." Mm-hmm. There's a complete shift in relation. And it's not just, "I love you," it's, "I want us to come together again." I think they say at one point how everything's fallen apart a couple times.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't fix a problem until you acknowledge it, right? So how many families, how many businesses, you know, how many situations in life have crumbled apart because people refuse to acknowledge there's a problem?
Yeah.
I mean, on a bigger scale, just look what's happening in the United States right now with the coronavirus, where who refuses to acknowledge it's a thing, and it's getting worse and worse. Just by coming out and saying, "This is bad, you know, wear masks, keep your distance," that would change everything. But it seems like a simple thing to do, but it's not.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What do you guys think about that? I wanted to talk about this, and you talk about acknowledging a problem. I'm glad you brought that up. The idea of Trey is a monster. There is a fascinating conversation between, what is it, Emily?
Ty, not Trey.
Is it Ty?
Yeah. The director's Trey.
Oh, my mistake. Sorry. Ty, you're right.
Tyler, so they call him Ty, yeah.
Tyler, my mistake. There's a fascinating conversation about Ty between the dad and, is it Emily? Did we say the daughter's name is Emily?
Yeah.
Where she says what he did is evil, and she is freaking on him, and she says he's a monster, and he says he's not a monster, he's not evil, he's just a human being. I would love to know what you guys think of a comment like that.
I mean, the whole film, the whole first half of the film was just about creating empathy for someone else and understanding why bad things happen, right? Mm-hmm. We process so much information every day. It's easy to say that guy's a monster, that guy's a bad guy, rather than, well, you know, he didn't get attention at home, he was addicted to opioids, and he had a drinking problem. Like, it's just easier to write someone off. You know, like, even look what's going on anytime you open up social media, right? It's like everyone's either the best thing or the worst thing. There's no middle ground. We don't have time to really dive into anything.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that, man. It's everyone's so quick to be clear cut and like just have an opinion off of a headline and a little bit of information. You know, in this case, it's a little bit different because his sister knows, you know, the brother more than, you know, the audience or the viewer does. And even to that, she doesn't know everything that's going on with him. So there's information still missing. But, yeah, like when we see stuff like that, like, you know, someone getting murdered or whatever it is, someone being raped, we look at that and then it's like, yeah, that's an evil act. That's horrible. But that doesn't mean that that person is like, you know, doesn't deserve, you know, grace, mercy, and empathy, you know.
Yeah, walk a mile in their shoes first, and then you decide.
Exactly. Like, you don't know what happened that brought that person to that point. And everyone is always pointing fingers and condemning others, but it's like, what about yourself? I'm sure there's things that you've done or that you're going through that if it was found out, you would be embarrassed. You wouldn't want people, you know, to know those things either. So I don't know, especially in the social media area and having internet, everyone has a voice and opinion and is quick to say it and feels like, you know, what they're saying and the things that they're typing or whatever is law.
There's another way to look at it too, is like what he did is horrible. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to say he's different than me, I'm not capable of that. But if he's capable of doing it, I'm capable of doing it, you're capable of doing it, right? Yes. And people don't want to process that if you were in his shoes, you might have done something similar, you might have done something worse, you know? So it's very easy to just distance yourself by saying he's a monster, that killer is a monster, that guy who went and shot up a school is a monster, and said, like, it's much scarier to humanize him and realize, like, you know what, that could be, like, someone I loved or cared about, or it could be me.
And in this case with Tyler, like, I know they said it was second degree murder. It was murder. But at the same time, it's like that could have easily been manslaughter and could have been a lesser sentence. It was an accident, right? He hit her. He wasn't expecting to kill her. It's just the way, being intoxicated, anger, all of that stuff, and how she felt. She ended up dying from it, right? Like, I know so many people that, you know, have gotten into fights or even have abused a female, being a man and stuff like that. And it could have ended the same way it ended for Tyler, but it didn't. You know what I'm saying? So, like, so those things could have quickly changed in their life. You know, how they're living their life now could be very different. So, you know, like what Victor is saying, like, we got to get back to, or not get back to, but we have to be aware, like, these as humans, this can happen to us depending on whatever situation we're in and what happens and what takes place and what is influencing us at a time and all of these different things. It can change everything just like that. You know, and going back to what he was talking about with the music and the film and one day at a time or just another day, you were talking about that.
What a difference a day could make.
That kind of stuff. Like, yeah, that's real. So, you know, what a difference a day can make. You know, you hit your girlfriend. Yeah, she might have a bloody lip or a nose or whatever, but what if she fell? What if it was on the stairs and she fell down? You know, it can be very different. So, everyone is capable of doing something like that. And so we need to stop judging so quickly.
Yeah. Agreed.
That's the thing I love most about this movie is that it takes some people who have done some terrible things. Because it's not all about Ty. It's not all about Ty. It's also about Luke's dad.
Yeah.
And Luke's dad, who is dead to him, and yet he's at his bedside when he dies. The conversation that kills me is when the dad is there and he's saying, "You don't have any regrets." And the dad's like in tears and he's like, "Yes, I do." That's all he says. I think it's his only line in the movie is, yeah. "I do." And he says, "You don't need to. It's okay." Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, in that moment, he's still his dad, even though he's been an ass most of his life. He's still his dad. And this idea that there can be, you know, you talk about waves again. This is almost like a wave of grace and perspective that falls and crashes in this moment that hits at the same, like that conversation between Emily and her dad, that kills me every time. You know, he's like, he's just a human being. And like you guys have said, like that's just who he is.
Yeah, and you're better off. You have to find ways to make peace with things, right? Because life, you're going to go through highs and lows. You have to find a way to ride them out. So, like, just to take it back to politics, is like Donald Trump. I can open Twitter. I can check the news. I turn on CNN every day, and he's doing something horrible. He's lying. He's cheating. He's stealing. He's abusing his power. And I can get up and just be mad to start the day. I could be angry. I can think of how can I exist in a world where the leader of the most powerful nation in the world is allowed to get away with this, and that could consume me and make me bitter and jaded. Or I could look at him and say, like, that's a broken man and I hope he gets the help he needs, and just try and go through life. Like, it's hard, it's struggle for him, but it's like, how's Victor going to live a better life? Like, being mad at all the injustices, or finding ways to make peace with things and fix them and improve them.
Yeah.
It's interesting you bring up those two scenes. So, talking about the fishing scene and then the scene of Emily and his dad in the hospital, because when the dad is with Emily at the fishing scene and he ends up breaking down talking about his wife and he's losing her and all of these things, and he says he's sorry for crying, that's where you see his, like, that we talked about him being macho and being that manly guy that's not being vulnerable. That's the first time that we really see it right there in that scene. And Emily says, no, it's okay. Thank you for sharing this with me. And then when he talks about her brother being a monster, he says those things that we just talked about, what you were saying, you know, he's just human. But then he also says, you got to let go of hate so you can love. He says that, right? Mm-hmm. Then fast forward to this scene in the hospital. Luke hates his dad. He has all of these regrets, he finds out. But then he just hugs him and they break down, and it's kind of him letting go of that hate so that he can love him. And that's what the father wanted. That's like his dying wish. But then I contrast that with Emily and the brother back to when they were both hugging each other in the bathroom when he was going through it. And it's like her redoing the hug and letting go of that hate, that monster, that animal picture that she had of him and that she shared with the dad, and loving him again. Like, yeah, he is a human. He just made a mistake. I thought that was a beautiful contrast and parallel and fulfillment of what the dad was talking about. She was able to finally do it and let it go. I thought that was a powerful scene, though.
It's funny, you know, well, funny isn't the word. Nothing in this movie funny is the word. but, you know, looking back on my life, I've been Luke, and I've been Luke's dad. Where there have been times when I've just been like, man, I was not in a good space, and, you know, I need that. I need someone to say, it's okay. I've been the one hurt, and I've done the hurting. When I hear Ronald say he's a human being, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I mean, and that's why I think in some ways this is one of the toughest films of last year. Because there aren't a lot of movies that I've seen that are willing to admit that, yeah, these people have done wrong, but they're not monsters. And there's something common experience about it. I don't know whether I'm saying it right or not, but...
Yeah, you are. We're all human. We're trying to figure it out.
We're all trying to figure it out.
We're all big, beautiful messes. Every last one of us.
Yeah. Anything else that we haven't mentioned?
I mean, yeah, we just spoiled it silly, but...
That's okay.
You can go into it blind. You know, like any other movie you're going to see, just its structure is going to blow your mind. It has an incredible use of music. Visually, it's just exciting and colorful. The camera's always moving in all these dynamic ways. It's filled with beautiful performances. It makes you think. You can have conversations after. I think the politics of having a white filmmaker tell this story got in the way of it maybe getting a bit more award season run. But as the years go on and people look back on it, and as this director, you know, becomes a bit more famous, I think people are really going to look back and recognize this as being a special kind of film.
Yeah. Oh, the color, man. The color and the camera in this one. And the music, it's just always, always moving. Absolutely gorgeous. And water. We haven't talked about a movie called Waves. We haven't mentioned water. Water is in, like, most of the scenes.
Yep.
That's true. There's one scene that that I want to quickly just talk about or address.
Sure.
That we haven't yet. And it was when, so Ty, you know, Ty is on the run from the police. He goes home, right? And he leaves the house trying to run away, like, you know, and the cops see him. He ends up going in the back of the police car. And this is beautiful camera work, too, and everything that they did. But while he's in the back of the car and they have, like, a close-up from, like, his chest or his neck up of just him in the back of the car, you can see behind him. But there's like a light or, like, a sun kind of shape behind him. And as the police car is driving, you start to see, like, that light that's like a sun almost. It starts to set behind him as it's driving. And it sets, and eventually it comes and the screen goes black, and then the scene ends and it switches. And I just thought, wow, like the visual of them saying, like, this is the end of Tyler's life, and that light and that sun kind of setting and it's symbolizing that because of what happened and him not being charged for that. I thought the way that they communicated that and displayed it was, like, brilliant and beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Well, on top of that, too, this film changes the aspect ratio several times. So if you notice, like, the bars at the top of the screen, it starts to, like, narrow, and it's almost a box, like an old TV. It's showing that he's boxed into his fate. Like, he's screwed. There's no way he's getting out of this, and it gives you more of a claustrophobic feeling. And then when the film switches back to Emily, you literally see the screen, like, opening back up.
That's a good point.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that. I'm reprocessing that. You're right. I hadn't noticed the aspect ratio changes and stuff.
Yeah, it gets tighter and tighter as the film gets more intense. And I mean, like, this is such a visceral film that even when he wrote the script, he put, like, he used color in the script for certain words, and he would put hyperlinks. So as you would get to a scene, you would click on it, and it would play, like, the Kanye West song. He's like, then this song's going to play here, and then Frank Ocean's going to play here. Like, it's all about creating a vibe more so than most films.
Yeah.
You have to experience it to believe it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Like, when he's on his way to the prom after party in the house, and, you know, he broke up the pills, and he's sniffing it, and he's drinking. He's playing Kanye West, I Am a God. Like, I can't be touched, you know?
That's so perfect.
Driving to this party, there's no one can do anything to me. Like, I thought, wow, that was, yeah, you're right. The songs they picked was really perfect for what they were trying to communicate in that particular scene.
And it's really hard to get licensed music in a film because you have to pay for each song. You have to approach each artist in each studio, and they have to grant you permission, and then you have to buy it. So, like, the music was so integral. I believe Schultz said he got, like, 80 or 90% of the songs he wanted to use in this. So, like, a year before the film was done, he was writing to people. He would be writing to, like, Kanye West publicists saying, like, hey, we really want to use this in our movie. Here's the script. This is how the scene would go. And I mean, the script was so good, a lot of people just signed off and gave them the music at a, like, really cheap rate.
That's dope.
Yeah, it's perfect music, perfect use of music in this film. Doesn't matter what scene it is, he catches the vibe of it in every single one of them. It's just incredible.
I thought it was interesting too. I don't know if there's a connection to this, but when Luke and Emily is in the bathtub together and they're playing Frank Ocean, I just thought, man, the brother looks like Frank Ocean. they have the hair dyed, right? You have the blonde hair. I think they were playing the blonde album as well because that was the album cover it showed. But I just thought, that's interesting. But obviously it was the song choice that they were saying. It wasn't about the cover.
We actually spoke to the director and the actor. Yeah. And I was asking them about that, like the character's hair and the costumes and the production design. And they said that Frank Ocean and Odell Beckham Jr. were an inspiration for the character to have that look because they just wanted him to feel like young and plugged in and like day run-of-the-mill, you know, teenager you would find in Florida. Mm-hmm. But he did explicitly say Frank Ocean.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah. Yeah, and I think one other thing, too, that the film does well is, you know, those relationships and those hard topics in reality of, you know, how something tragic affects a marriage and a family, right? Like, usually if someone passes away or something, there's a high rate afterwards, especially if it's your own child, that divorce will happen because parents blame each other, you know, these kinds of things. But so they lose their son, and he's minimum 30 years, mandatory, he has to serve. It could be the rest of his life, though. And, you know, the wife mentally checks out, and every time she looks at the husband, she says, every time I see you, I'm reminded of the son, you know, and she blames him for it. You pushed him too hard, all of these things. And she suggests that she wants to have a divorce. And then kind of throughout the movie, ever since that scene took place, she's more kind of distant and he's losing her more and more until the very end where he walks in the room and she's sitting in his bed and they hold hands. And it's kind of like, you know what, maybe let's just fight this thing out and stick it out. I'm not going to blame you anymore either for what happened. But, you know, like those dynamics in that relationship, like that's a reality for a lot of married people, you know, when something like that happens. And it kind of leaves you the way that it ends too. Like, I don't know if that's something that we want to address too. I was kind of bothered how it ended. I was like, man, I wanted to see kind of more, you know, like, but it does a good job of leaving it open to, so you can kind of draw your own conclusion. So I appreciate that as well. Like, I wanted to see that, the scene of when she comes back home and her telling her family, like what she said in the text, I'll tell you everything when I get home. I love you. These kind of stuff. I wanted to kind of see that, what that would look like, but it leaves it open for you to speculate and draw your own conclusions. The same with the relationship between the wife and the husband. Like, yeah, they hold hands, but are they going to make it, or, you know, do they eventually get divorced? You just kind of...
I think the whole thing, point of this movie really is to tell you, like, life doesn't have a happy ending, because there's no ending. It just keeps going. It keeps coming in waves, right? So it's like maybe they're going to make up for a while, and then they're going to have some more fights and be distant. It's just, it's never going to stop. You just got to learn to ride it out, make peace with it.
Yeah,
see, that's interesting, because I got the distinct impression that not only is everything going to be okay, they're living in a new reality, sure, but I got the sense that, like, him walking in the room and taking her hand, like, I like Jordan, you said, talk about them being together. Her text message saying, I want us to be a family, so I want us to be together again. And then that last scene where she's riding the bike and her arms are outstretched, you just get this sense that the forgiveness that they've talked about has made them free. She's riding with her arms open into the sun. But yeah, I mean, there's still reality, because the movie opens that way. You're right. Like, the movie opens the same way it ends, with her riding on her bike.
Bookends it. Yeah.
So, I mean, so go ahead.
I think the difference is, it's not, I don't think this is a film that's going to give you a happy ending, but it gives you the hope of a happy ending, right? Mm. So if the, like Jordan said, if he thought the movie was going to end halfway through, like, that could have been an entire movie.
Yeah.
And even though it wouldn't tell you where the characters ended up, you would know this is terrible for everyone involved, right? So it's like they went through the worst possible thing a family can go through, and they still rode the wave until they got to a place where they have the potential to be a family again, right? And that's all you can ask for, because you don't know what's going to come through. Like, the dad could get cancer tomorrow, and there's another wave to ride, but they have the hope and the potential to, you know, be a loving family again, which is as good a happy ending as you're going to get.
Yeah.
Here's a question.
Realistically.
Yeah. Here's a question to throw at you both. And I know it's sort of ridiculous, but how do you think the movie changes in terms of the way we view it if it ends at that halfway mark? If it ends with the story of Ty, what changes most significantly to you?
I walk out of the theater massively depressed.
That's fair.
I think it's still a great movie, even if you just finish the movie at the first half. And even though it ends in a dark place, it's very empathetic the way it gets there. You know, like, he does a terrible thing. We understand he's not a monster. Even like his sister doesn't get that, but we spend the whole first half of the movie with him. So it's like, yeah, like, this, bad things happen. And it's not because people are inherently bad. It's because they're in bad situations they can't get out of. So I still think the movie works in a completely different way. But I'm glad they spend the next hour with Emily.
Yeah, so I definitely agree. And I think for me, what I would add is that if it ended with Ty's story like that, it's just like, oh, it's another stereotype of a black person going to jail for murder. Like, they could have had any other one else there. Like, we talked about, could have been any other family, you know. But it's a black guy that kills a girl, and now he's in jail, and that's it. And it's just like, well, why are they doing this? Why couldn't they choose someone else? That's what I would be thinking. But it continues, and you see, like, you know, again, this person is human. These things happen. And the story doesn't end there, even though it may end there, quote unquote, for Tyler, because he's in jail. Who knows if he gets paroled and his life goes on and whatever. But if it just ended at that, I would have been like, oh, man. Like, it doesn't look good for, like, it doesn't look good for black people.
Well, to take it a step further, this is one of the things people have issues with this film, is that Tyler, he goes from, like, the American hero, the cool kid that everybody loves, to America's nightmare, right? A young, dangerous black teenager who's a murderer.
Yeah.
Whereas Luke comes in and he's the white guy, and he's the white, sweet. Mm-hmm. He's not intimidating. He's the, you know, he's full of heart. He's like America's sweetheart. It's like, you know, optically, that's pretty bad. You're saying, like, the black guy ends up being a killer and the white guy is the sweetheart.
Yeah, he's the savior. Yeah.
Yeah, white savior.
That's true. That's very true.
But is he? I see what you're saying, and I agree with you in the perception, but I would say that she saves him.
He initiates it. Right? It's like he takes her on a journey because she's walled off. He introduces himself to her. He shows her kindness. He warms her heart. And then he introduces her to this journey they have to go on to go see his father. He opens the door and she's the one who takes them through it. But I still think, like, he comes in and turns things around for her. Because if he wasn't there, like, that story does not end well.
So yeah, for sure, definitely. And I think too, like, he does end up help, like, they help each other, but like what Victor is saying, you know, he initiates it. And the way that the movie goes, they're focusing on her family and her story. If it was focusing on Luke and they met, and you get to see kind of more what was going on in his life and why he hates his dad and how he right. was brought up, even though he initiates it and she comes, then they kind of look like, oh, you know, yeah, she did a lot for him. Look what he did. But we know more right. about Emily's story opposed to Luke's story, so it could come off like he is that white savior, America's sweetheart kind of guy.
Right. No, that's fair.
What do you think? How would you feel if the movie just ended after Tyler goes to jail?
I think what Jordan said, that here's another, the fall of another tragic black character. That's kind of what I thought it would be. I never thought of it from the perspective of the white savior complex. Never thought of it from that perspective. I feel like had we watched the first one, it's much more of a cautionary tale and doesn't end up having the courage that it does by the ending to get to a bigger message. Ty is a sympathetic character. You hate watching it. We've already said he's not a monster. But if you cut out that second half that fleshes out the relationships and how Ty's actions affect those around him, I feel like the movie, not just, it would, you're right, it would be totally depressing, but not just that. I just feel like it would be a story that is just trying to tell you, hey, you know, people do bad things. Here's a guy who had it all and threw it all away. I feel like it loses a ton of perspective. And I feel like a movie like this needs it. But even as I asked it, I wasn't really sure how it answered. But man, I do not want to see that movie. It's not the one I want to see.
We see that every time we turn on the news right now.
Yeah. It would just be another heartbreaking drama.
You never know. Maybe Michael B. Jordan shows up and gets him out.
They're in Florida. He was in Alabama. So, you know. anything else you guys want to talk about?
Go support the film. Stream it. Rent it. Buy the Blu-ray. Buy the DVD. We need to see more films from Trey Edward Schultz. The guy, he has talent, man.
Vic, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me and Jordan on it. Jordan and I are continuing on in our series. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back next week with Moonlight. We, as always, you can find us wherever podcasts are available, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify. You can find us on your Alexa device via Stitcher. If you go to the podcast page at screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, small group questions that can help get the conversation started where you are about the film, which hopefully everyone will see. So thank you guys again. I really appreciate it. And for you at home, as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.